Welcome to Farming Aotearoa with agricultural journalist Peter Burke. Hello folks, and welcome to this, which is going to actually be our final episode of Farming Aotearoa. It has been great having Peter Burke in with me every 4 weeks. He's in the ag sector. He is an agricultural journalist. You work for Rural News as well. Welcome to studio today.
Yeah, it's good to be here, and it's sad to go, but I think the decision is right for me to just pull back a little bit, getting to an age where it's time to probably play more bad golf and write a few books and all those things that I want to do. So that's part of the reason for it. But I'm still keeping to work full-time for Rural News.
Yeah.
So there's been quite a lot happening around at the moment. And the big one that's dominating the rural sector and in fact, the whole country at the moment is the announcement by government the other week that they're going to reform local government. Now, that didn't surprise anyone because they were already going to reform the Resource Management Act. So this, in some ways, is a bit of a... It's a party to that in a way. One thought once they were going to do that, then maybe they would look at local government, and they have. The government has come up with an idea that they will abolish regional council laws. They won't be a job for them at some stage in the future, and that they are going to give the mayors of all the districts in that region to form a panel to come up with a way of restructuring their region. And it sounds, the slogan politics would say, getting rid of regional councils, well, it's not quite that because you can't get rid of the functions. You've got to still keep with those. So you are getting rid of, or supposedly getting rid of, a group of politicians. And there's a lot of talk about what this really means. And it's an interesting one to me. I came in when the last restructuring took place in 1989. I joined the Regional Council of Wellington Regional Council then. So I know a little bit of experience of working for two councils and a local authority in that period of time. What does this mean? Well, it doesn't necessarily mean the government says, and there's maybe some truth in it, that they will reduce the bureaucracy, and that's fine. They say that it will bring down rates. That's, well, who knows?
To be seen.
To be seen, and you know, will it just mean that the rates won't go up for a while? It's been put to me that there are a number of reasons for this. There's been a lot of unhappy people about the decisions being made by regional councils. And to be fair, to some extent, they've got themselves to blame for this. Because you do get inconsistencies around the country. If you were, say, have a farm in, say, the Manawatu, and one half's in there and the other half's in the Waikato Regional Council, then you may find that there are two different sets of rules for your farm, down literally by a boundary fence. So it isn't the same. There was an inconsistency. But it's fine to blame the regional councils, but then you could also argue that the government haven't set very clear definitions of what is or should not be there. So there's a bit of both. It's not all the regional councils' fault. The other thing that says about the cost is that central government have quietly handed over certain responsibilities to regional councils to do, but never given them the money to do it. There's a governance problem right across local government. It applies not only to regional councils, but it applies to territorial local authorities, in other words, your city and district councils. And there's a comment made that people who get elected to those are not up to the task. And I think that's very fair. Having worked there, I've seen it. Some people come there with the best of intentions, but are quite frankly dreamers and don't understand what they're even there for. Some of them don't even know. I remember going to one council where someone made a speech what they were going to do, and the chairman had to politely point out to them, well, we don't do that anyway. So someone got elected to somewhere where they thought they were going to do something, but were not able to do it full stop. So you've got the dreamers, I won't use some other words around it, but people who are single issue related. And there's others who I think with the best of intentions get on there to try and make the best of it. However, you don't get the best of decisions because a lot of wacky ideas get put forward. And we see that particularly in territorial local authorities, not so much in regional councils, but you do get some wacky ideas there that get placed. With territorial local authorities, you do get staff who interpret the government rules and make their own, which are very strict and unbending. And sometimes I think they become obsessed with being very strict about what they do. And the councillors themselves, I don't think, have the ability, the nous, the intelligence necessarily to say, stop here. They've let them go. When the councillors have questioned that. I've seen it, been through it. The council staff will hire their own lawyers, their own peer reviewers, and then put up a case, which if you're a councillor and you're faced with a lawyer from an outside organisation, a big company, saying you can't do this because of, it's very hard to say, well, I don't believe you. But we've got to face the fact that lawyers give you opinions. They don't give you facts. They give you an opinion. It's a legal opinion. And I think that there has been a lack of control on the part of regional councils' elected members, as there have been of territorial authorities, to stop some of the crazy decisions which get made. And I think that's the problem. It comes down to that. It comes down to the staff. It comes down to other outside influences. So what's going to happen? Well, we're going to have the mayors supposedly going to provide a new structure. And one has to question whether the mayors have got the capability as well. I mean, are they any better than the regional councillors? And my answer to that may be no. They're not necessarily going to be. And what are you going to get? I don't know. This is, someone put it to me and said, this is a bit like a Donald Trump idea where you sort of have a disruptive idea, you throw it out in the open and see what happens, and maybe there will be a good answer, but maybe there won't be. And if we look at politicians and staff, staff are there to retain their positions, and the more staff a CEO gets, the higher his or her salary probably will be. A councillor does not want to do anything that would see them not elected, so they don't do courageous, and I've seen that. That's a quote from the US Prime Minister. I had an example once in my own life where a councillor proposed to do something. I said, if I said yes, they'll do it. If I said no, they'll probably do it, and I just said courageous, and they didn't do it. And no politician will do anything courageous. It is beyond them. It simply means that it means they'll lose votes, so they don't do it. So we've got the situation, and I just really wonder what's going to come out of all of this. No one can tell you. It's conjecture. The mayors have 2 years to get this together, supposedly. But government have also put a caveat in there and said, well, with these groups that we put together, we might put one of our own in there who might either guide them or they might, in fact, veto the whole thing. So we don't know where it's going to end up. Bear in mind, this could roll over to beyond the next election. If it's 2 years to do it. So it may not happen, I don't know. So we're in this quandary at the moment of people with different views of what's happening, and this is creating uncertainty. They say it will simplify local government, it possibly will. The thing that's being talked about is a thing called unitary authorities, and they exist at the moment in places like Gisborne, Nelson, Marlborough, Tasman, I think is one other one, and they work, but they're very... they're very much one council focused. It's Gisborne District Council as a unitary authority, which does its own tasks of regional councils. And if you start to bring in, say, a region like Canterbury, it's got Christchurch with big numbers in the city and a lot of rural areas. If the voting goes for a population basis, then the city outvotes the rural area. And you can see already farmers saying, what does this mean for us? Are we going to be outvoted in this? Is the city going to dominate us? Where are we going to go? And I think there's a lot of that real concern being expressed as to how this thing will fall out. And as I say, I don't know the answer. All I know is that it's a big one and that we are going to be struggling to see how this whole thing pans out in the long term. So I know it's a long thing, but I think watch the space for the next 2 or 3 months, watch the space for the next 2 or 3 years, and don't necessarily expect your rates to go down because they may not go down. They may do. We may get rid of some of the bureaucracy. There's a reason for saying if you amalgamate them, then there will be less in the corporate area. But there may not. Who knows? But the thing to remember is that what regional councils do will still have to be done by someone. They can't not be done because it's about managing the environment. It's about flood protection. It's about regional risk management, emergency management. Those tasks, pest management, they can't go away. So it's not a case of abolishing the things, it's saying who will govern them and will they do it better. And I'm not going to say who will do it better. That's up to others to make that decision, not mine. So, yeah, okay. Interesting one.
It is indeed. Okay, talk to me about Hawke's Bay.
Hawke's Bay is interesting. I was up there a couple of weeks back and it surprised me to see how dry some of the hills were. Normally in November you would see, well, this was November, the hills were quite brown. As you drive into Hastings, and I've never seen it quite so brown in my time going up that way in the last nearly 20 years. So there is a problem there. And I went to one farm where the farmer showed me his dam. You couldn't, the ducks could hardly paddle in it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it is very, very bad in some areas. And some of those west-facing hills are really very, very dry, and there's not much feed around. What we are seeing is hearing him say that that the company that runs the stock trucks up there has never moved so much stock in November that they've done this mid-November, because people have just been getting rid of their stock so that they can easily cope with the drought, or better cope with the drought. To be fair, farmers have become much more attuned to what's happening in terms of droughts. They're better at it. They're seeing, they're not waiting in the hope that rain will come. The tendency is to get the stock off the land so that at least they're not going to be ending up with stock struggling. And frankly, the prices have been reasonably good at the start of the season, so if they were able to get rid of them at a reasonable price. And if you think about it, it's better than having to buy in silage or hay or whatever it might be to feed them, because you're just going to lose money on that. They're not going to grow. They're just going to maintain weight. So I think we are seeing a situation which is not getting any better. I haven't heard anything too much around what's like in Gisborne, but I do know that it's still, even for, just looking at the land, it was quite staggering to me. It was almost what it was in January about 2 or 3 years ago.
Mm.
It's okay. Early. And the thing is, it is basically at this stage a sheep and beef issue. We'll talk about Horton in a minute. But dairy doesn't. There are dairy cows in Hawke's Bay, but they don't amount to very much in terms of the local production. So it won't have a great effect on the local, or should I say, on national dairy production. But dairy farmers are going to have to be thinking about what they're going to do.
Mm.
We saw this in Northland last year when they had to bring in stock, they had to bring in water tankers to fill up the stock troughs. Now, I don't know if
that's pretty dire.
Yeah, it's pretty dire. And I what we're seeing at the moment is, if you look at the weather forecast at night, you're seeing very, very high temperatures in the east coast. You're seeing winds up there which dries it out, and we all know what that means. So it's a combination of heat and dry, and I just think that we're going to watch this space over January. If it continues this way, we don't get rain, it's going to be a pretty dire situation up there for all farmers and others as well.
Okay, what about the apple season? What's happening there?
Well, the apple season is interesting. There's a couple of things on that. Last year they had a very good season, and this year it looks pretty good as well. The fruit has been good. Last year that was their best year they've had for a long time. Interesting enough, it came on the back of, Gabriel.
Yeah.
So they did quite well. And all the orchards were saying that it was one of the better years. Everything just fell into place weather-wise. It didn't with Gabriel. That's why it did. And the crop was good, and the fruit was good quality. No problem with labour as we used to have in COVID. That seems to have got over that problem. It seems to be all right. And this year it's looking quite good as well. I was looking at some of the trees there. The young apples are on the trees. We've had the bud burst. It's been good. And there's lots of fruit appearing on the trees. So the question will be, how can that be sustained as we come up to the... And I think what we're going to see in Hawke's Bay particularly is that the orchard of Cyberswith, they're irrigating already. It is that dry. They're having to irrigate their trees just to make sure that they don't lose that impetus that they've gained. It was a bit late. It was a bit of a cool winter, cool spring. But then the winds came in. He was telling me that the wind actually helped open the flowers. The bees got in, so pollination was quite good. So the orchards up there are doing better. But of course, if we'll go back and look at it and say, well, what's it doing in terms of the balance sheet? And we'll talk about tariffs in a minute. But it's still very hard for those guys, because they're not. The balance sheets are still not right there with Gabriel.
Yeah.
They're living on debt still, and it's a long way, because if you think about the one orchard as I knew, they lost 180,000 trees.
That is a lot of trees.
It's a lot of trees, and they can't plant them back there. They were in the Esk Valley. That's all gone now. There's no planting of orchards in the Esk Valley, because
the tops all gone as well.
Well, tops all gone, but also the financiers say it's no, because you can't mitigate another disaster. Right. We won't loan you to plant in that area again because the risk is too high. So they had to walk away from that. They leased the land for which they didn't own it. But even to, if you take 2 years to get a tree up to nursery stage, then you've got another 4 years for it to start to mature and produce a crop of any sort. And one was telling me that he thought 10 years was about the time it would take to break even. The one I was talking to said that they've had 1 year in the black since COVID.
Wow.
It's because things have not gone right. But, you know, they're picking up, they're getting close to it this year. They may well, because they've got to service the debt, that's their problem. They still can't do it. And the question is, how long can they survive? The comment is made that how long will the banks also put up with this? They're keen to get, they're not keen to invest in Hawke's Bay because of the risks there. They're keen to get orchards off their books if they can. They won't, they'll stay with them, obviously. But the long-term prognosis is that maybe some orchards will have to bring in external capital to keep going, because if they want to expand or get going forward, they simply haven't got the cash reserves to do that. So we may see some orchards being either new partners coming in, new venture capitalists coming in to support it. You may see them sold even potentially to others who have got the money to do it. I don't know. But it's certainly a challenge. And, you know, as he put it to me, the physical damage is not so evident now. If you go to Esk Valley, yes, it looks terrible still. It's not great. But by and large, the areas that were hit are not looking too bad. But the balance sheet damage is still pretty is evident if you look at it. There's no one's got a good balance sheet up there at the moment. And you're seeing people selling off assets. You're seeing some of the land that was hit by orchards. The trees have been pulled out. Crops are going in there now. So, yeah, there was a whole lot of other things happening on the side of that, which is making it a challenge for our good friends, the orchards in Hawke's Bay, which is, you know, one of the pineapple growing areas. And they're getting new varieties in, and, you know, that's part of the whole deal. So, yeah. So, talk about trade and tariffs with apples too.
Yeah, let's do that as well. Yeah.
Yeah, because interesting, same guy was telling me there's no point in exporting to the States anymore because of the Donald Trump tariffs.
Yeah, you've been talking about this for a little while. We've all heard about it a lot on the news. It seems crazy.
They can't. He said simply, well, a 15% tariff, it's just our profit.
Yeah.
There's no point in going there. There's other compounding factors too. Because of the situation in the Middle East, a lot of the ships are being diverted around the Cape, not going through Suez easily. And what once might have taken 38 days to get a crop of apples to Europe might take 100 days now. And that's no way to send a crop of apples to Europe. And this orchardist was saying to me, we're no longer going to, this year we're not going to send any apples to the States at all.
Wow.
We're not going to send any to the Northern Hemisphere as well either. We're going to focus entirely on Asia. And I think that's where, it's partly because of the shipping thing.
Yeah.
It's cheaper probably. Mm. And you've got a guarantee of not having to go through some troubled waters, I guess, to get there. And that's quite a difference. Now, whether that will change, but we've seen Trump lift the tariffs on beef, and he did on avocado, I think, from memory, or something like kiwi fruit, particularly. But for the apple growers, it's you know, it's still high tariff, and he said, you know, it knocks about $2 a box off us for a box of apples. Well, he said that's our profit.
Yeah.
So why bother with it?
So he's taking the relief though off the US, the beef, sorry, in the US.
Yeah, the beef is not unsurprising because. The Americans want beef from us. They mix our lean beef, our grass-fed beef, with their own beef, which is largely raised in feedlots. It's grain-fed. So if you look at American beef, go get a steak there, it's pretty fatty. And their mince is quite fatty. So what they do is they buy in our lean beef and mix it with that. Because the staple food in America is a hamburger, essentially. Mm. That's what they mainly eat, mince. That's okay, but that's what they do.
Yeah.
So the beef farms are doing quite well at the moment, and they've been doing quite well over a period of time. They haven't lifted the tariffs on lamb, incidentally, which says that Americans don't eat lamb. It's a rich, it's a high end product. So we're not seeing any relief on that front from the Trump administration at all. Maybe that will come. I don't know. That's all these things, trade things. with Trump are so unpredictable, and even then people are saying, well, we cautiously welcome the decision. In other words, let's hope Donald doesn't have a bad night's sleep and change his mind in the morning. You never know.
Oh, who knows?
It is really there. But we are seeing a real example now of what these tariffs are doing and how bad they're affecting exporters such as apple growers.
Mm.
At, you know, no go to America.
Yeah. Tough year on the old avos.
Yeah, the avos not doing too well at all. It's been a bad. They've had bad weather, which hasn't helped them at all. And that's, you know, that's part of farming, I suppose, or orcharding, whatever you like to call it. You're always going to get bad years. But they've also struggled a bit with their markets as well. They made a decision to Australia took most of our crop. Well, I think 40% goes to New Zealand. It's 40% domestic. The other 60 goes export. It's quite. Quite a high domestic.
It is a lot, yeah.
It's a lot. So we grow mainly avocados for the local market, as we do sort of the salad type things we grow. But the Australian market has declined, and then it's now down to a lower number, about 50 or 40%. It's now down to about 20.
So they grow their own avocados as well.
And now New Zealand's looking
not at, as good as New Zealand once.
No, but they're Australians, and they probably don't have the same taste that we do. Anyway, the same refined taste, should I say. But we are looking to other markets in Asia again. It's the same thing, trying to move to Asia. But we have got the American market, obviously, small numbers. Avocados are not big as an export, but they're important, and there's some very big operations, particularly in the Northland area. So, yeah, not a great year. They're hoping that they can pull things through, but there's no guarantee they will pull things through. So that's another one, and see what happens.
Okay. All right. What about the cost of trees?
Interesting story. This. When we saw Southland on television, you saw trees and you saw power poles down, all that sort of thing. And the first thing that brings to mind is what trees do. Now, I've been through that on my own little life sentence block once. Where
life sentence block.
Well, yep. It is, and I've got rid of it now. I've got out of jail, as they say. But trees are a problem, and you see it a lot. Trees are planted along highways. Guess what? They fall down. It gets wet. Wind comes up. They fall down. They bring down the power lines. They also block the road, so they also create problems getting access to areas. And I was talking to the electricity people about this, and they're saying, well, they spend about $67 million a year trying to proactively get trees away from power lines. And I had a great experience with a local company, Electra, here, where I identified a problem on my own farm and said, look, I've got this issue, what do you think about it? They came and said, yep, okay, we'll do it for you. We'll do it for you once. We'll get this down, because we know that if it did touch the lines, then it would cause a major outage for a whole lot of people. And they did that, and they did a couple of other things for me too. And they do that on a one-off basis for you, but next time you're expected to pick up the cost of yourself. I did one other one on my own farm, which I took down a tree at my own expense because I feared it was going to do that, and there was no reason for them to do that. But it is a problem, and that's what we're seeing, that that people have got to think about where they plant trees, and the cost of that is great. It's just, as I say, the cost not only of breaking down the power poles, the power lines, but also blocking access to places which are remote and difficult to get to. So you've got to, you know, chainsaw the tree, get out the road, unblock the road, then get up to this place. And they're asking people just to be a bit more careful about how they do it. Identify a problem. Do it proactively rather than wait. If they see a tree on the property which is looking like it might fall over or could damage a line, give the local lines company a ring and say, look, I've got this problem. What do you think I should do? They will probably come and have a look at it. They may do it for you, or they may advise you on what to do with it. And the reason that they will probably do something about it in the first instance is it's easier to do something down when there's not a big crowd. You know, knock a tree down now as opposed to waiting until a whole lot fall down, and it's a major mess for them. So there is method in both. But just a warning about the cost of that. And the answer is, if they could, there was some sense around this, maybe then the power bills would drop. So that's something that's worth. You're also seeing a lot more trees coming around now with more forestry blocks. We've got the carbon farming issue around at the moment too, of course. How will they do? And the aim is to try and keep you. If you look at through the main forests in the North Island, you'll see that trees are planted well away from the power lines.
Yeah.
They have to be, because they were damaged there. So, yeah, that's the issue there. So, right.
Right. What about Winston on
Winston hasn't stopped talking down Fonterra's decision to sell off the brands. He's still saying that it's a bad idea. It's a short-term thing. It's done and dusted now. The farmers have voted to do it. They're all going to get a Christmas present of sorts, thousands. And you can make your own mind as to whether it's a good idea or a bad idea. There's pros and cons on it. Winston has a view that says it's a short-term fix. It's a sugar fix. You'll get your money now, but is it the right decision? And you know, there are two sides to the story, clearly. So, yeah.
Okay. And finally, a story about drones.
Yeah, interesting. I'd never thought about drones much before. I've seen them. I've just taken pictures. But happened to be over in the Wairarapa and heard about a farmer who's just got elected to the Beef and Lambs New Zealand's Farmers Council. And he is on a farm, his folks' farm, at a place called Omega Station out on the coast. And he is setting up an agri-drone business. So he's got this large drone which can carry a payload of about 50 kilograms of spray or of fertiliser, and he's making a business out of this. It was fascinating to talk to him about what he did. I never really knew much about them, and it's quite a big one. If you go onto the Rural News website, you'll see a picture of the size of the drone. It's quite big. It's not the biggest. There are now bigger ones around, but they're not saying the drone is the answer. It is a certain niche operation on a farm, like if you've got gullies which are quite small and you can get a drone around those better than you can get a helicopter around them. If you want to spray out a small paddock and it's difficult to spray out, you can do it with a drone. But what was interesting to me was that the training you had to go through to get to be a drone pilot. It's just not like I'm buying a drone from Woolworths and I'll have it running tomorrow.
And up she goes.
Up she goes and all's well. No, you had to buy your drone, which cost you about $40,000.
Whoa.
And then you spend about $60,000 to get your license to operate it.
Jeepers.
And about 10 months to do that.
Wow. Okay.
So you've got to learn, you've got to prove, you've got to pass written tests, you've got to pass practical tests to prove you can fly it. And you have to be signed off by the Civil Aviation Authority. So you just don't just go out there and fly it. And then on top of that, you have to get what's called an ag rating, which means the same if you're a commercial pilot and flying a top dressing plane or a helicopter, you've got to get the same thing. You've got to get a chemical rating to prove, you know, to handle chemicals. You've got to get a rating to prove you can handle fertilizer. And they have to do that. And then once they've got that, they have to fly 32 missions with someone supervising them the whole time. So they just can't go out and once they've got that, once they can prove they can do it, they've got to be watched for another 32 operations to prove they can actually do it. So it's quite a task to get there, and once they do, then they're free to fly anywhere. But it takes about a year to get to that stage. So it is, I thought it was quite interesting that there was that in it, that you just couldn't go out there and buy a drone and start doing it. It was all tied up with this idea of getting a license, and that's it. So it's quite a fascinating thing. So that's it, yeah.
Well, that's it. We finished on a drone story.
We did, yes.
I wonder what we started on. I have to go back and listen to it.
I know, yeah, okay.
Well, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about all things farming and agriculture. It's been an absolute delight having you in the studio with me.
I enjoyed it with you too. It's been fun, and I'm going to miss it, but I'm sure you'll find someone else to do something like this at some stage in the future.
If anyone's interested, they can certainly contact us.
That's good. That would be good if they did that, but I think probably for me, we're into an age now, I think probably it's starting to pull a few things out. And I have to do a few other things of mine. And that's fine. But enjoy it. Good luck to you for the future.
Lovely. Thank you, Peter.
This program was made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.org.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.